Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the clinicians, the CEOs, the founders, the investors and any other people that we can find with interesting things to say that are leading the healthcare revolution in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and founder of a health tech venture myself, which is called PocDoc. PocDoc is revolutionizing how we can screen massive sections of the UK population for cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes. We work extensively with the NHS. If you're interested in learning more about our products and how we're helping people through the NHS across the country, please head to PocDoc.co. That's PocDoc.co. In 10 minutes, we have something called a healthy heart check, which in 10 minutes can deliver the equivalent of an NHS health check just using your phone or tablet. So thanks to PocDoc for supporting the show as ever. I'm actually in PocDoc HQ today in our operations facility, which is fantastic to be here. As I say on every single show, thank you so much to everyone listening live on UK Health Radio. Thank you to UK Health Radio for the live platform. Johan and his team do an incredible job. It's not just our show. There's great content right the way through the day. And all of the shows are available on all of the podcast channels. Us specifically, the Health Tech Hour, if you're listening on any of the podcast channels on our channel, the Health Tech Hour channel, thank you very much for downloading. It's great to have you here. Please subscribe and make sure you get all of the shows. If you're watching on YouTube or watching on my Instagram channel, it's great to have you. We kind of slice up the best content and put out that content as we go. So thanks a lot for being here. It's really great. We have listeners from all over the world every month. It constantly blows me away when I look at the geographic spread. And look, you know, I really appreciate you guys showing up. It's really great to have you. So on the last show we did last week was with Hazel Wallace. So thanks to Hazel, if you're listening, for coming on. Hazel is AKA the food medic. And it was really incredible, actually, to hear her journey from a 14-year-old who tragically lost her father to a stroke due to cardiovascular disease that inspired her to become a medic, and her journey through the NHS to become the food medic. And now her sort of the next phase, which is really a focus on how nutrition can help support women through their whole life of their whole lifetime around their reproductive health. So it was a really interesting show, really inspirational. And you can go and download it now and listen to it if you want to. So on to today's show. It actually gives me great pleasure to introduce today's guest, Dr. Sara Kayat. Dr. Sara is a practicing NHS doctor specializing in sexual and reproductive health, which was part of her BSc that she did at King's College, and actually continues to run a weekly surgical clinic in and around the orthopedic sector. But listeners might be more familiar with Dr. Sara as the resident GP on This Morning and her TV work like the host of GPs Behind Closed Doors. Dr. Sara has also published a best-selling book called How to Have a Baby, which is the essential toolkit for the preparation for pregnancy, labor, and for birth. Sara, welcome to the show. How are you?
Yeah, really well. Thanks so much for having me. That was a lovely intro.
Yeah, we do good intros on this show. Yeah. We do good intros. It's something that we've worked on. So look, there's quite a lot I'd love to get in with you into with you on this show. So, but I'd like to kind of start with what was your journey into medicine? Because in my experience, limited though it may be, medicine is a significantly important choice for people. It doesn't seem like a pathway that happens accidentally. It seems very much like a positive decision at a young age to go down that pathway.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I don't think you fall into medicine in the same way that you might other degrees. I always thought it was something that I would do because it is a decision I had made, when I was a kid. At the time, I think I thought I like people, I like science. I want to do that whole I want to help people thing. I don't know if at that time I really. If I'm honest, you pick the subjects you're going to do really early on to do medicine because you have to have certain criteria. So you have to have biology, chemistry, physics, or whatever. So you have to pick those quite early on. And I think when you're age 14 having to choose these things, you don't understand the gravity of your choices. We were looking at these old home videos, me and my family, recently, and there's one where I'm really young, I'm probably about 8 years old, and my brother's interviewing me, saying, "Sara, what do you want to be when you're older?" And I said, "I want to be a doctor." And so I'd obviously known from that early on that that's what I wanted to do. And then my brother goes, "Why?" And I said, "'Cause my dad's making me." And I have no recollection whatsoever of being coerced into this. I always thought it was something I always wanted to do, but obviously there had been some little
Some
hints
hints.
dropped along the way by my family. So I think, they probably encouraged whatever it was I had in me. And then here I am. It was a huge decision to make at a very young age with probably little understanding, but it's the best decision I've made. So.
That's
I'm
amazing.
really lucky to have made
And
it.
what was the support like as sort of 14, 15 around the STEM, like science, technology type of choices, science, technology, maths type choices at that age
You know
when
what?
you
I'm extremely lucky. I went to a girls' school, which was super feminist, and I knew nothing about the fact that anyone outside of that school would think any differently of me.
That's awesome.
I've always been brought up. And to think that I could do anything in the same way that anyone else can. And I owe a lot to my school, actually. I think they're a great school that supported us. So I'm extremely lucky. I know a lot of people don't have that didn't have that kind of push and impetus and encouragement. But I always did, and I knew no better. So I turned up at medical school just thinking I was the bee's knees and that I can do it all.
Yeah, I mean, I remember. I mean, I did not do medicine, but looking back, interacting with medics, it was quite a hardcore. It's, I mean, quite naturally, it's a really important job, obviously, but it's quite a heck of a course, isn't it? I mean, it's a heck of a training.
I
I mean. It,
genuinely, I agree. I really think that actually they should consider making it a postgraduate course because I think when you're 18 and you rock up at your at university and you're doing Freshers Week and everything's going wild and you're super
Yeah.
happy to be there, you're probably not paying attention to that really important core module that you were supposed to know about how the kidneys work.
Yeah.
Whereas all the postgrads were people that have been through other things, have decided actually I'm older now, I'm wiser now, and I still want to do medicine.
Yeah.
I think there's some merit in considering that in the future, but because I'm sure there are gaps in my knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit because, like, you could do like natural sciences and then kind of specialize, right? Potentially, like postgrad.
Exactly. So, there are lots of people that do, biomed, natural sciences, neuroscience, any of them, those kind of scientific cores, and then branch out to do medicine after. And then you've got so much base knowledge, but you've also got so much more of a drive, I think, in a way, because it's the second time round and you've got all the partying out of your system.
Yeah, exactly. You're kind of a little bit more aware that there's a real job at some
Yeah,
point that has to
exactly. Because
happen.
I love it now. Now I go to courses and things like that, and I'm sitting there, eager beaver,
Yeah.
front of the course with my notepad. Whereas
Yeah.
I definitely was the backseater in.
what was the interest when you specialized in sexual and reproductive health?
So at that point, I think I did that postgraduate. That was because I'd started general practice and I had primarily female patients coming to me. And I felt like, you know, they were coming to me because they thought that I could offer an insight into their bodies that maybe a male doctor didn't necessarily have, or at least maybe the empathy that they, you know, male doctors can't have
Well,
necessarily.
there's also just like a, you know, sometimes there are some things that you might want to
Yeah.
discuss with someone of your own, you know, gender. I
Exactly.
think that's kind of common.
And so I was getting, you know, all these female patients, and I just thought, no, I can't be offering advice as the, you know, as this and not be able to give the best advice that I can in this field. So I went on to kind of do diplomas in that, and it then kind of spiraled because I did that, and then more people came to see me about it because I then knew that, and then I just ended up being that person, and it's lovely because I love. You know, I do love speaking to other women about things. You know, of course I'm happy to see male patients. Of course that's the case. But there is something really nice about adding your own experiences with your medical knowledge in the advice you give to people.
And do you feel like when you were starting, because I didn't realize that your sort of the prompt into that area was because of your experience as a GP. Do you feel like, oh, sorry, different question. What was the sort of general approach to like reproductive health when you were kind of starting out in that GP role? What was the kind of baseline standard of training, give or take? Like, what was the approach, that type of stuff? I mean, to the extent that you're willing to share, because this
Yeah,
came up in some of the previous shows that we've done.
sure. I think baseline information in medical school was pretty minor. You know, you get your short rotation in obstetrics and gynecology. You get to watch a couple of births, get it signed off, and even during those births, you're being kind of shooed out of the room by the midwives who were also training at the time, and everyone wants to see this birth, and it's chaos. Like, to try and get you, I think, how I don't remember how many you had to sign off, but maybe let's say five births that you had to watch. It would be like you against the midwife, against the nurse, against everyone, just trying to be like, no, there's a birth, there's a birth, and like everyone's head just poking. And I feel so, now in retrospect, I feel so sorry for that poor woman who's lying on a bed birthing and has all these students and trainees just desperate to get a glance so that
Just
someone will sign their piece of paper.
get
It's
to get was is
awful.
I don't want to trivialize it, but like, did you have to see certain bits for a certain minimum amount of time to tick it off, or was it like just as long as you
No.
kind of like what where you know what
Yeah, what
constituted
counted
it?
as no, you're quite right. I think you just had to be there present for the ejection.
Fair enough.
But the training, you didn't get a huge amount of training, especially in London universities and schools, because that's where you think you're going to get the most, because you think actually that's where most people will end up birthing because there's, you know, a larger percentage of population. But actually, there are also so many other trainees, so it was difficult. So I don't feel like I had as much knowledge as I would have liked, and that probably was why I ended up, you know, in part doing the diploma because, yeah, as I said, people were seeing me and I'd seen a birth. Like a corner of a birth. Like, that's not okay.
And like how much the issues that were coming to you, how much were about, well, sorry, what bits of the overall reproductive health lifetime of women were the ones that people were coming to you, or was it just everything? Or there wasn't any particular
Yeah, you'd have
area?
everything from, you know, the young girl whose periods just started, but they're, you know, irregular and painful, to the 20-something-year-old who wanted contraception, to the menopausal woman who needed advice. You know, you get the absolute, you know, myriad of patients and their reproductive journey. So yeah, it was nice to be able to. It's nice to have that breadth as well. You know, you're not just focusing on one area. I ended up kind of working for a short period of time in, well, about a year. I say short, that's quite long. In a sexual health clinic as well, and that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that because it wasn't.
Was it different to what you expected? Does
Yeah,
that
really different. In my mind, it was all going to be, you know, contraception and STDs. And instead, I just learned about like a whole new world of kind of sexual experiences that people are
Right.
having, but
Okay.
also a lot about their anxieties, and people are just so much more open in that environment, more so than in general practices,
Right.
I found. So I guess I got to know people so much
Is that because
more.
they're so, is that because they've kind of, why do you think that is? Is that because they're not seeing their regular GP, so they feel like it's a bit more, there's less risk, they're not going to come back and see the same person potentially, or like, what do you think that
Maybe
is?
that, or maybe that they know that it's an environment where I'm expect, like, they're expecting to go there to talk about kind of sexual experiences probably, and whereas when they go to the GP, they sit in front of the GP and it could be anything. It could be, oh, I've got a verruca, or it could be, my elbow hurts, or it's, I've had multiple partners and everything's going a bit wrong. And I think they're worried that they're going to offload this piece of information that they're going to feel stigmatized towards, or embarrassed about. Whereas when you go to a sexual health clinic, that is what we're going to be asking. We're expecting you to tell us all these things.
That makes sense. And like, what's your view? I'm kind of dancing around a little bit, but I remember reading some stuff. I think it was either during COVID or after COVID about the funding for sexual health clinics being cut dramatically.
Yeah, it's really it has been, and I don't work in that sector anymore, but I do have a lot of patients that say, well, when I say to them, oh, this is going to have to be something that you see a sexual health clinic about, they'll say, well, I've tried, but I can't see someone for X number of weeks, and obviously this is a more immediate issue.
Urgent,
And
yeah.
I do think, whereas before it used to be, drop of the hat, oh yeah, I'm just going to pop to the sexual health clinic, and you could just go, walk in, it would be a lot easier, but that's not as easy anymore.
And does it, and does that have a, does that have a sort of noticeable overspill into primary care then?
Yeah,
Because
I do exactly
people are
that.
not going to sit on those issues. They're personally probably quite sensitive issues that they feel
Exactly.
are quite urgent.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think it does overspill into primary care. So whereas someone would automatically have gone to a gun clinic, a sexual health clinic, now they may think twice and say, actually, it may be easier to get a telephone consultation with a GP, although it may not be.
No.
And then see if they can treat me first, and if not, then go to the sexual health clinic. So yeah, there probably is an overspill, but these areas, they all mulch into each other. When there's no appointments with us, they'll go to them. When there's no appointments with them, they'll come to us.
And then they might even end up at A&E at some point, potentially, if
Exactly,
it's
exactly.
really, really uncomfortable. Okay. And how did you end up going from that sort of environment into the sort of journey where you are now on as sort of resident GP on the telly and things like that? I'm guessing it wasn't like an immediate switchover, but what was that? Where, how did that kind of come about?
So I was in my first job after becoming a GP, qualifying as a GP. And a production company came to the practice I was working in, and they said, we'd really like to film a program called GPs Behind Closed Doors here.
Okay.
And we need a certain number of doctors to say yes, and for you to say yes to this. And then we can go ahead. And then I remember being like, oh, this sounds so cool. This is so much fun. Yes, I want to do it. Hands up. And we got eight people saying yes, and they needed nine. And I was like, oh, yeah. I remember going up to one of my colleagues, Chris, and being like, Chris, you have to do this. You have to do this. Come on, this will be so much fun. And eventually he gave in, and we did it. So it was a fly on the wall series. They, cameras in all of the rooms, and people are consented as they come into the practice. You have to be filmed. And surprisingly, a lot of
Well, so I've seen the show before even knowing that you were coming on this show. I knew of the show. I love all of that type of, I love all that stuff, that genre, if you like, of the documentary fly on the wall type thing. And I my immediate reaction to that entire show was how amazed I was that people were so comfortable on camera talking about very in often very intimate issues. And like how so Like what, how did that really, were they just okay with that? Or like, I mean, that what's.
Yeah, so I think some people are just okay with it. Others, I think they come in and they think, okay, I'll sign yes, and I'll only talk about a certain issue that maybe isn't quite as sensitive. But done. You can't see the cameras anywhere. It is a normal
Oh, you can't see
consultation. And
it.
I
Okay.
wonder whether, I mean, the cameras are in the corner of the room, but unless you're specifically looking for them, you probably wouldn't notice them. And I wonder whether a lot of those patients think, actually, I feel comfortable, I'm with my GP, I feel okay. And then they end up opening up more than maybe they would have. But all of those patients are then consented again at the end of their consultation
Oh,
to
really?
make
There's
sure that they're
another.
still happy for it to go
Okay.
out. And
Okay.
so I guess there are just some people that are altruistic in that way. And actually, it's a lovely thing to do because
Sorry,
it
go on.
makes a lot of other people feel so much more comfortable about their problems.
Well, I was going to say, like, I've no idea if this got tracked in any way, shape, or form, but my sort of gut feel would suggest that that has a halo effect and it encourages more people to talk about more things more openly. It's like, well, if someone's on telly talking about that, well, I can probably get to my GP and talk about it privately.
Exactly. It removes stigma for so many conditions. And I remember, at the time we'd get a lot of messages from people saying, thank you so much for talking about this. It's been an issue for me and I now know I can come forward about it. And yeah, it's a really lovely thing to do. So to all those people that did it, thank
Yeah,
you.
thank you so much. I mean, to a point around them coming in and then sort of ending up talking about lots of things. When we were in the early days of PocDoc, we would be doing things, or I would be out doing different types of screening, cardiovascular screening. I'm very focused around cardiovascular disease. So it's the sort of lipid profile plus Q risk plus a few other things, all within that space. And you'd sort of be doing this, and then people would just be volunteering information about all kinds of aspects about what was going on with their health. And it was sort of, they were asking questions about, well, my bowels are doing this and my thing's doing that. And I'm like, look, that's what's really a little bit out of scope about what we're trying to talk about now with cardiovascular disease. Not really my area. So I can totally empathize with how that might happen.
Well, I mean, that's testament to how comfortable people must feel around you, which is nice because obviously,
That is nice. Yeah,
yeah.
that is nice to know. Right, so we have to go for our first commercial break now, but we will be back after 2 minutes with the next part of today's show with Dr. Sarah Kiat. And I really want to get into the next step. Two things, depending on how much you're willing to sort of, I've got tons of questions around what the reality is like as a TV medic versus the not. I'd love to try and dig into that a little bit. And then we can kind of riff on the various different things about the NHS and women's health and reproductive health. So, got a ton of stuff to talk about. So, we'll be back in 2 minutes.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the second part of today's show with Dr. Sarah Kiat, qualified GP, practicing NHS GP, and resident medic on ITV's This Morning and GPs Behind Closed Doors. So, on the GP show Behind Closed Doors, how much more was it more or was it more successful than they thought it might be? Like, did it touch it? Did it like hit a zeitgeist type thing? Because I feel like
Yeah,
it might have done.
absolutely. So we were the, I think there'd been a short kind of pilot series before us, and that, yeah, and Channel 5 bit at that and said, yeah, this looks good. And then we were the first major, like, I think it was maybe 24 weeks, maybe longer.
Oh, wow. That's
Yeah,
massive.
it was sizable.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly how many, but it felt long.
Yeah.
And then from then on, there've been, I don't know, 10 series or something ridiculous since
Yeah.
then. So I think people realize actually there's such an appetite to know about other people's health and how that influences your own health.
And do you feel like, that, or sorry, how much do you feel like those shows, specifically when it deals with GPs, help general punter, if you like, understand the reality of what it's like working as the GP? Because when I go to the GP, I have a 7 minute or a 10 minute, and then I might not go again for however many numbers of months. But do you feel like that made people more aware, more sensitive, more appreciative, or not really? Like, didn't really have that type of impact?
I think it helps people appreciate the complexity of some people's conditions and why we might be running behind time, and things like that. Because, often you would see, or certainly they would show the patient consultations that were probably a bit more complicated or a bit more interesting, and then people would say, "Oh, okay, fine, yeah, squeezing that into 10 minutes, having taken 5 of those minutes to take off your jacket is probably, fair enough that you're running over." But I guess, I don't know. I think it probably helped people appreciate that. I whether it made anyone appreciate, I don't think its role was to make people appreciate us and our role, to be honest. I think it was there to let people know that they're not alone. I think that was its main kind of goal, but that might have been a little
It
upshoot.
definitely did that. I mean, I think it definitely,
Yeah.
it definitely did that. And so at what point was there a transition into the this morning piece?
So after it had been aired, I think, a few episodes in, I got a message through the production company saying that This Morning wanted to have a little chat with me.
That, how did you feel? That must have been pretty exciting, getting that message.
Absolutely mental. And I, crapped my pants and went to the meeting. And I don't know what I was expecting. I don't know. Like, to be honest with you, I was working most, mornings. I didn't get to see This Morning very often. I'd only ever watched it when I was on school holidays and stuff like that. So it was scary, but incredible. So I met this lady and she just said, "Yeah, we'd really like to put you on a little trial. Come in next week." And there you are. And I remember they put me on with Dr. Rand, because I guess make sure that I'm not a mentalist in front of the TV,
Not
like
a complete
that would
lunatic.
be cool. So yeah, it was a fully on-air trial of live TV, and I remember they're going, "And we're live in 3, 2," and I said to Rand, "Do I look in the camera? What do I do?" He was like, "Just yeah, don't just look what I do." And I was like, "Okay." And that was just as they're counting down 3, 2, 1. So I'm just staring at him intently for most of it. "What's he doing?" But it all went well, and then they just kept asking me back, and it was incredible.
And did you I've always wondered whether maybe because you were a GP and they're basically private employees, you can kind of do what you want, right? Or do you have to kind of get a bit of permission from the NHS to moonlight, or is it kind of kosher?
No, yeah, you don't have to get permission to do it. You just need to have the right kind of insurance and indemnity and stuff like that. And I think it's always nice to speak to the practice you're working in and making sure it aligns with their ethos as well. Because I know some practices feel a little less comfortable with social media and doctors being kind of available to others. So yeah, I think it's probably more an element of politeness, but you can do what you want.
And how much do you identify with this phrase, the media medic, which I've heard of, I've heard it's kind of I think it's more applies to the TikTok kind of, things like that. But it's come up in a couple of conversations, kind of on this distinction between more information and awareness about conditions is better versus trying to make sure all information is valid, accurate, aligned with the healthcare system out in this wider world of media, social media.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? Social media is such a rabbit hole. The problem, I suppose, is, does media medic mean that you're a doctor? I don't know. I guess the
I
titles
don't know.
are not. I worry. I suppose I worry if there are people out there saying, "Yeah, I'm a media medic," but does that mean that they're actually qualified to give any of that advice? I don't know. But then I call myself a TV doctor, and I hate that phrase too. I just think all of these phrases sound really
Well,
awful.
it's a TV doctor. Yeah, it's like I, yeah, TV doctor always makes me think a little bit about the flying doctors. You know what I mean? It's like the same. You know what I mean? It's like I'm the doctor on TV, and then I don't know. I can see that, but I don't know quite what to.
At least the doctor part's there, so you know I'm a doctor. But yeah. I feel like it detracts from the fact that I'm actually a normal doctor too.
Yeah.
So media medic sounds a little bit more professional, but does that mean I don't.
But have you had any sort of younger doctors approaching you to sort of be like, hey, how does this work? How did you do it? Has it gotten more, or is it sort of flatlined?
Yeah, I would definitely say it's getting more and more that you get people asking how you do it. And I have to just keep saying it's absolute serendipity for me. Like, they're all like, oh, well, so who did you speak to get this role? And like, what do I need to do? And I was like, I got to work one day and they were there.
Yeah.
So I feel like I can offer very little advice, but to be honest, people are so savvy on social media now, and I'm unfortunately not one of those people, but there are people that are managing to get such traction and so much audience views, and I guess it's just the hope that those are also people that take care of the information that they put out there.
That was one of the things that we did an NHS menopause special a few weeks ago with Linda Barker, TV personality of Changing Rooms, and she's a menopause campaigner. And then an NHS menopause specialist called Bookie Iowardi. So shout out to Bookie if you're listening. It was a really interesting debate around the role of social media, specifically in menopause information, where I'm sort of paraphrasing slightly, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but there's lots of different symptoms that may or may not mean also other things. And so the diagnostic process is more complex, and it's unique to every woman. And there's different options and different things you can do based on, biology and existing health conditions and, what you might want to do. There's a kind of plurality of different things. It's not a very specific diagnostic pathway like elevated cholesterol. Okay, well, if elevated enough, then statins. It's nothing like that.
Yeah.
And they felt like, well, the discussion was around, well, more awareness around menopause is net good, but how do you try and create a situation where the information is as accurate as possible, particularly in a condition where there's so much plurality of pathways?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think unless there's a specific algorithm, as you say, lipids, etc., then a lot of medical conditions get extrapolated to many different people inaccurately. And I think that's kind of partly why I ended up writing a book, which was not something I'd kind of ever thought about doing originally. But
This is How to Have a Baby.
Oh, yes.
Yep.
So I wrote How to Have a Baby. Mainly because I was pregnant and I was online researching things, trying to get some information about various stuff. And I just kept getting loads of anecdotal information and lots of opinion. Or you'd get the really kind of beige NHS line.
Yeah.
But there was no kind of meat to it. There was no further information. There was no resources. There was no, these are the numbers, these are the stats. And I just kept thinking, well, if I'm struggling to get the information and I know where I'm meant to be looking, then imagine how everyone else is feeling. Yeah. And, I can go and look at the research papers and I can appraise them and I can, decide if it's a good paper or not and then digest that information. But I'm trained to do that, and most people aren't. And not only that, most people don't either have the time or are so bloody tired when they're pregnant that they don't have the faculties to do all those kind of things. And I just thought that's the kind of thing that needs to all just be put into one book. And I guess it's the same, with the menopause, and that's why there are a lot of other doctors out there now writing those specific books, hopefully to try and get that condensed information into one place that you know is safe.
Well, I think one of the issues that to be great to get your thoughts on, this came up in the relation of the period cycles and pregnancy, not necessarily, period cycles and menopause, not pregnancy, but the kind of completely underwhelming lack of research funding for scientific clinical work to actually establish facts around different things within those spaces. So, I don't know whether that kind of applies as well to pregnancy, because it's not something I've looked at, but I imagine it must be quite difficult because you can't really run clinical work with pregnant women because that's not great, I
Yeah, it's
suspect.
entirely unethical. And so
Yeah.
there's huge disparities and gaps in the knowledge in terms of pregnant women, to the point where it just means that we rule out so many things on the off chance that it might not be safe. And obviously that is more important, to do it that way than the other way, but it does leave us with huge gaps in our knowledge and unfortunately loads of women who aren't able to take certain medications and treat certain conditions because just not sure. And
Okay.
I just feel like we're not doing enough. We're not doing enough to protect our pregnant women when it's already such an vulnerable time anyway. But I guess the question is, what can you do if you can't use a pregnant woman as an example?
And what we'll let around that quick, like how did you go about plugging some of those gaps that you felt were important to plug in your book?
Well, I think it's I think some of the gaps are about the kind of emotional roller coaster of pregnancy. You tend to get a whole load of information out there about all the positives, all the wonderfuls, and that's good as well.
Yep.
You're gonna end up with this great baby, and what happens when that's not the case. You need to know so that you can then be forearmed and forewarned and make the right decisions. And it was just simple things like, for example, induction of pregnancy. So if a
Okay.
woman gets to a certain point in their pregnancy, we suggest in the UK that you become induced so that basically mimics the whole labor process so that you then get the baby out. And I think some of
Is
the
that
gaps are
is it oxytocin they use for that? Is that what it is?
Yes, exactly. It's a synthetic oxytocin.
Yeah.
And I think when a woman hears, oh, you need to have an induction because if we leave it longer, there's an increased risk of stillbirth, for example, most women are going to say, oh my God, of course, yeah, induce me. But I think it's important that women know about relative risk and absolute risks, and they're taught about this kind of information because, for example, like the relative risk of not inducing and stillbirth is 5 times. So you're 5 times more likely to have a stillbirth if you reach 43 weeks versus 37 weeks. But the absolute risk is 10.8 in 10,000 versus 2.1 in 10,000. And so actually, when you think about the relative risk, it's not that high. And you might say, well, actually, now I know that, I'm willing to wait an extra week. But no woman is given that information.
No, and also, I don't know quite whether even I have no idea how it is. I guess this would be training, but the actual w w when those dis even it's not just about the information, but actually about the interface between the woman and the clinician in that environment, whether that's even an encouraging situation to be able to explore options, or whether it's more of a sort of top down, this is what you have to do. There isn't really another option.
I feel like a lot of women that I've spoken to do find that it's a much more dictatorial kind of process, that they really do take the patient role, and they don't feel that they have that autonomy to counteract what's being suggested. And that's fair enough because they've not been given the information to be able to counteract it with. If you don't know what you're supposed to be asking, then you can't really you put your hands in the life of that surgeon or gynecologist, et
Midwife
cetera.
or
And
whatever,
that's
yeah.
fair enough, but I think you do need to still be able to challenge some of those views. And I don't think you can challenge it unless you've got that knowledge there.
Yeah, and do you really feel, I guess you do because you said it, but sort of were you surprised when you were pregnant and you were looking for this information? Had you assumed that it was sort of there all along, waiting for you at the point where you became pregnant, and then when you went looking for it and it wasn't there, you were surprised, or did you just kind of know all along it wasn't there?
No, I was completely surprised. I genuinely thought it was all there waiting for me in some like panacea of a book or a website. And I was like, oh, this is great. I've heard people talk about Mum's Net. And like, you know,
Yeah.
I was like, and then I get onto Mum's Net. I'm like, whoa.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
There's not much on there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, not specific to Mum's Net, bless you.
Yeah,
Like,
sure.
that's great.
Yeah.
But it's more just I couldn't find the referencing. I couldn't find the facts. And I desperately wanted them.
And so, and kind of like pulling a bit more of that thread, like referencing something you said earlier about the sort of the information that sometimes is communicated by the NHS is so risk managed to the point of being bland, you know, not in a bad way, but they, you know, they're trying to sort of, I guess, manage different priorities, you know, risk and things like that. Like, do you think that then the role of providing this information is more of a private type concept, or it's a continuum, it's never binary? How much of it should be then partly due to the NHS improving how it provides information versus being the role of somebody else, in this instance you publishing a book or whoever else decides to go and do something like that?
I think that the issue is that there are some people that will want to go through their pregnancy only knowing that basic amount of information, because that's where they feel safer and they feel that they want to be able to put their hands into the, you know, their lives into the hands of somebody else and, mm-hmm. and, you know, come all way. And that's completely an okay way to do it if that's the way you want to do it. So I think there's only so much that can be provided on a basal level from you know, the NHS. Also, you know, people's understanding of research studies, of, you know, the factual basis of things are going to be different. You know, people are going to have social disparities, you know, and you've got to be able to accommodate for everybody. So I get why it is that way. But yeah, I think if you are the kind of person that has the appetite for more information, it is something you then have to go chase yourself.
That makes sense. I wonder, like, do you think that, because there are certain sort of communities or groups of women that just have naturally higher risk of different diseases or different conditions, and that can apply in pregnancy, is my understanding. And like, do you think that those risk-based discussions are happening in primary care, or is there still a nervousness around even engaging on that element of it?
I certainly think that I think it's a bit of a double-edged sword, because I think in some cases, so for example, gestational diabetes is increasing risk, you know, in Southeast Asian, Middle Eastern, etc. Yep. And I remember, because I'm Middle Eastern, so I got my gestational diabetes appointment in the packet. It doesn't actually go through why I've specifically been invited.
Okay.
I do this, but other people don't necessarily. And so when I was saying, you know, I'm off to my gestational diabetes check, someone else was like, oh, I haven't been invited to that, why? I love. And so I think, yes, there are some areas that maybe we need to improve on. Having said that, maybe they've done research into it and said, well, actually, if we put that information in, maybe people feel that there's less equity there and then they don't want to go.
Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah, I do feel like that wasn't highlighted. But then there are other areas like BMI, for example, which I feel get really hammered into some pregnant patients. And I think to a point where, you know, it can even be a little bit cruel in how it's being delivered. Because if your BMI is, you know, raised, or even if it's low, you've got some risks associated with in pregnancy. And I think it's a time when you're already feeling very emotionally vulnerable, and being humiliated or made to feel more vulnerable because of something you potentially can't do much about at that point either, is difficult.
I think that's also like, that could be a reason around the non-communication around risk, ethnicity-based risk things, like, for example, gestational diabetes, because you can't change that. So there's nothing you can do to affect that risk. And so why make a deal of it?
I wasn't
involved in that decision. So we're going to go for our last commercial break now, and then we'll be back with the last part of today's show with Dr. Sarah Kayat. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the final part of this week's show with, the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with my guest, Dr. Sarah Kayat. So, Sarah, what is coming up for you? Have you got more books, more TV shows, more GPing? Like, what's going on? What's in the future? What does the future hold?
Yeah, a little bit of everything. So yes, definitely more GPing. That's never gonna end until like a ripe old retirement year, which is probably gonna be 99 by the time I finish. But that's all good. and then yeah, I'm still doing this morning, which has been a lot of fun for me. And I get to partner up with some cool brands as well, and people that I believe in. I get to do some nice charity work as well, partner with charities that I really believe in, like so I'm an ambassador to Mothers to Mothers, which is an incredible charity that helps to lower the transmission rate of HIV in pregnant women in
Okay.
and
Mothers to mothers.
yeah, and it's
Okay.
beautiful. So
Out of interest, how does one lower the risk of mother to child transmission
They
HIV?
use a concept called mental mothers. So they take women who have HIV themselves, and they are within the community, and they set up these clinics so that other mothers who are pregnant, and have HIV can go speak to people that have actually gone through it all themselves and do it themselves. And they teach them about, vertical transmission, so how to limit it, part being passed on through labor, how to limit it with breastfeeding and, and bottle feeding and things like that. And then that kind of empowers those women. They then end up becoming mental mothers themselves. And then the message gets spread further and wider about HIV and lowering the risk of HIV itself, within their own community. So it's a great concept because you're employing women, you're empowering women, and you're building communities, and I just think it's beautiful. I went to South Africa to see some of those clinics, and they're doing amazing things.
This is why I love doing the show, because apart from the fact I get to talk to amazing people, we also hear about all of these amazing things that otherwise probably wouldn't have learned about. So I guess this is my limited understanding of HIV transmission. I guess this is partly, back in the day, sex education type thing. It's like a one and done. It's like you have unprotected sex, or you come into contact with some kind of bodily fluid that contains that from a person that was infected with HIV, and it sort of is a binary thing. You then like get it, but that indicates to me within the mother to child transmission that it's not quite as clear as that.
Yeah, no, it's definitely not quite as clear because we can yeah, it depends on the passages that they go through in order to the either like pelvic transmission or whether it's through a C-section as to
C-section.
whether you can increase the risk or not. And I think and then also with the breastfeeding and how to ensure that you're not getting any cracked nipples, things like this as well. And encouraging bottle feeding if that's what needs to happen. And I think it's all just it's all just an educational and an educational thing for them, like, because it's kind of a part of their life in some areas where it's just the concentration of HIV is so high, it's not become it's not something that they then end up thinking about, oh, how can I reduce that risk? Because it seems to
Right, it's sort
happen
of endemic.
naturally, it's endemic, exactly. But in some areas, they've reduced it down to 0%.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Mothers to mothers. Cool. Okay, and so more books as well, or what's the
No,
plan?
I don't know. I have. I've been toying with it. I wrote most of this book when I was pregnant. And so I kind of felt pregnant with my second. So I kind of felt like I was really ingrained in that area, and I was living every word that I was writing. So I guess I just need to find another topic that I feel heavily passionate and feel like I can actually offer my slant on it as well.
That you're personally connected to.
I want there to be some personal experiences. I just think that's what sets it aside from just being a medical textbook.
Yeah, and also like I can understand that there's an element of like you wanting to feel like you've got standing to talk about that thing, like you obviously did when you were pregnant, I can see that. So weirdly on that, I got contacted. So after, so I've, like I think I said at the just off air before we came on air, we've been on a run of women's health guests, which has been brilliant, and I love being able to use the platform that I have to raise awareness of issues that, for the most part, I think male commentators and male individuals aren't probably that comfortable generally engaging with. So, but weirdly, I got contacted by somebody who will remain unnamed, who he said in a quite a snarky way, like, hey, I've got an idea for you. Why don't you have a man come on and talk about women's health? And I was like, well, you want like two men to have a show about women's, like, how's that gonna, like, what does that even, I don't even know what you mean.
Not because of lack of knowledge, but I would feel uncomfortable writing a book all about testicles.
You know, erectile dysfunction, or, you know, that, like, I'm sure you're technically competent, but.
Exactly. And I feel like that just highlights a little bit of our gender inequality right there.
Yeah, I was a bit like surprised about it, actually. I was sort of quite taken aback. I started to extrapolate what an odd piece of content that would be.
And you know what, though? Like, there are a lot of male gynecologists and obstetricians out there, and they do brilliantly. And I've got a lot of patients that love them and just think they're just incredible. And so maybe I'm missing a trick. Maybe there is something about knowing, about not living it and just being able to give you the facts about it rather than feeling it. Maybe
I think it's an interesting question, because some of the largest women's health businesses were founded by men, it turns out, like Flow Health. There's two chaps founded that one, and this was a discussion I was having last week with Hazel, and it was like, does it matter or does it not matter? Because Flow does amazing work, it's an incredible company, like, from what I can tell, not a regular user of that product, obviously. But, like, does it matter? Does it not matter? Does it just matter about the content at the end of the day? I don't know.
Yeah, as long as the information being given is accurate and is helping people, and, you know, they're doing good things, and maybe it doesn't. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe you should say yes to him and see how it goes.
Maybe I should get him on and we can just see. The thing is that I don't want to come. I'd be more worried about, like, it might seem like I'd have to caveat the show so heavily, like, this really wasn't my idea, so if it goes badly, don't blame me, type of thing, you know?
This is a bit of an experiment. We just
We're going to have a go.
And do the same the other way around. Get a female urologist.
Are there male urologists? Female, that would be, do you know what? I'm going to write that one down.
There are lots of female urologists.
Okay.
So I think get a female urologist and a male gynecologist and...
Jill, that might be a great show just in and of itself, together.
There you go.
There. This is why you're in TV, you know? You come up with all these great content ideas. So, look, we've got a couple of minutes left on the show, and this is the section of the show where I kind of reserve for asking the guests, you know, because every single guest that we've had on the show has been through an incredible journey in lots of different ways, all completely unique. But I ask the guests around, what is it that you... either a motto or a phrase or an approach or a philosophy or inspiration that you think might be useful to share with anyone listening with their own sort of personal journey, whether it be business or whether it be academia or whether it would be their health. Like, what is it that you've, you know, because there will have been periods in your life where you've been so busy beyond belief or so stressed, but you've just cracked on. And you know, let's try and share it forward a little bit, I guess, is the point of this.
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily got anything to do with being a doctor or anything like that, but my motto that I'm always telling people is know your worth. And don't let people who have kind of a part-time position in your life take a full-time role in it. Know where you are. Know how important you are within your life, and know who is a primary person and who's a secondary person.
That's a great one. I've not heard that one before. That's fantastic. That's a really good one. So on that note, I don't think there's anything more for me to say other than, Sara, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me so much.
And, you know, look forward to seeing you on screen and reading books and doing all those kind of things. And thank you to everyone for listening. It's been great to have you. And we'll be back again next week with another show. Next week's show is all going to be around type 2 diabetes. focus on type 2 diabetes and the upcoming technology advancements in and around continuous glucose monitoring. So if that floats your boat, we will hear, well, we'll see you again next week. So anyway, thank you.